From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, big retailers getting big tax breaks on their big box stores in Michigan, and local communities are paying the price.
Michigan's appraised value for these properties is about a third to 40% of what they are in other states, and especially even in the home states.
It's not just Flint. Michigan's municipal funding system has a lot of cities in our state dancing along the edge of a financial cliff.
Now, when you get to the point where you're basically having bake sales to pay for your police and fire departments, there's a systemic problem there.
Talking about death, why is it so few of us have these important talks with our loved ones?
Just to give our loved ones some guidance about this transition from life to death, which will happen to us all.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But talking about death, what you want and don't want, why is it so few of us have those important talks with our loved ones?
So much of it is like, well, if I talk about it, it's going to happen. Well, you know, despite great advances in medical care, humans do still have a 100% mortality rate.
I'm Cynthia Canty. The good goodbye today on Stateside. But first, it's called the dark store approach to valuing property. This strategy is estimated to have let big box retailers cut their property taxes statewide by at least $100 million, all because of a ruling by the Michigan Tax Tribunal. This ruling lets the companies behind big box stores base their property taxes on stores that have closed, ones that are sitting empty, hence the name dark stores. And as the big retailers successfully argue across the state that they're being overcharged, it's towns and cities, counties and schools having to find the money to pay the retailers back. Here's one of many examples. In Marquette Township, an appeal involving a Lowe's store gave the company a $755,000 refund in overcharged property taxes. That forced the township to cut services such as public library hours. Experienced real estate appraiser and Republican Representative David Maturin has introduced a bipartisan bill, HB 5578, hoping to close the dark store loophole. Representative Maturin, welcome.
Hello.
Was this dark store strategy always in place?
No, I don't quite know how far back the new approach or track that the Michigan Tax Tribunal has taken has been around, but probably within the last 7 or 8 years or so, they've just taken a different approach that they hadn't taken in the past and that virtually no other state takes. And my legislation is attempting to bring them back to what I consider good, sound appraisal principles.
If I'm understanding this, the tax tribunal agrees with retailers that their fully operational stores should be taxed as if that store was sitting there dark and empty.
Right, and it's valued using comparables, and those comparables are generally older stores that have been set vacant for a while, hence the word dark. But in many, many cases, they also have deed restrictions on them that markedly impact the highest and best use of that comparable property.
So for communities, you've got the prospect then of an empty store, a dark store, with all these deed restrictions basically just sitting there, pretty well not able to be used, and then the newer store being valued at the same level as the dark store.
Right, that's currently what's happening. You've got a brand new big box retail store, newly built, and essentially using a sales comparison approach and comparing that property to other properties that I would not consider, from my professional appraiser standpoint, to be comparable properties that would have the same highest and best use. They don't have the same highest and best use as an unencumbered, relatively new big box retail store.
Representative, I started with the example of the Lowe's store in Marquette Township. What have you seen in your district?
We had a Costco store that was built on the western side of City Kalamazoo and Oshtemo Township, probably the hottest corner in southwest Michigan right now. It's at the corner of 131 and Stadium Drive, which is a major entry point into Kalamazoo, into Western Michigan University. It's no secret. I mean, it's been published. They paid $5.5 million for the land. They got a building permit for $12 million. That brings them up to $17.5 million for the new facility there. And the assessor put them on for a true cash value, not an assessed value, but a true cash value, which you could equate to fair market value, of $8.5 million. So already the assessor had a value on them about half of what they had into it. They didn't send her a dozen roses and say thank you. They sent her an assessment appeal. Mm. And they said the entire property, brand new, the day the doors opened, is worth $4 million. Now, keep in mind, I just said they paid $5.5 million for the land. They're saying land and building is worth $4 million, and they want an assessment of $2 million. I think it's just kind of the end game for this particular theory that's been adopted pretty much across the board by the tax tribunal for valuing essentially big box retail properties.
And I think it's worth taking a moment to just kind of refresh everyone's memory about the tax tribunal, because I think that's not top of mind for most citizens.
Well, it was started back in 1974 at the behest of then the state senator Jack Wellborn, who saw the tax commission at that point in time, who was the adjudicating body for assessment appeals. He wanted to focus on a different group of folks, and essentially the first tax tribunal had an assessor, had a real estate appraiser, had a CPA, because they also handled some non-property tax issues, and two attorneys. I think now it's expanded to another two members, but essentially they still have the three valuation experts, two of whom should know something about real property value, being the assessor and the real estate appraiser. But they are a separate issue, a separate entity. They're not under Treasury Department. They're under Licensing and Regulatory Authority. And they sit as the body that someone takes the case to when they want to appeal their assessment.
And the governor appoints this panel.
Governor appoints them. I believe there are six-year appointments. There may be some folks that have been appointed by Jennifer Granholm and some folks by Rick Snyder on there. I'm not quite sure where the terms would fall. But, yeah, they're gubernatorial appointments, and they sit as judges, call themselves tax tribunal judges. And the cases that we're talking about are when the entire tax tribunal meets, not the small claims division, which is a division where a homeowner would go to appeal his or her assessment.
Dig around a little bit and you find out that in Lowe's home state of North Carolina, Lowe's stores are valued at around $79 a square foot. In Michigan, it's $22.10. And Menards stores, they're valued about $61 per square foot. In Menards' home state of Wisconsin, here in Michigan, it's about $25 a square foot. So great for the companies, but not so great for our state.
And we had evidence that was introduced, I believe, back in December when we had two hearings in tax policy, and I'm vice chair of the House Tax Policy Committee. We had two hearings just on the general topic, and that was brought up about Michigan's market value. The basic appraised value for these properties is about a third to 40% of what they are in other states, and especially even in the home states of these companies. So you wonder, are all these other states doing it wrong and we're doing it right, or maybe we're not doing it right? And everybody else is on the right track.
Yeah, does this feel like an example of a policy that's just a little too business friendly at the expense of schools and libraries and municipal services?
Yeah, you know, I've been trying to stay away from the tax issue and getting somebody laid off. My real focus is on valuation, being the only licensed appraiser in the state of Michigan, or at least in the House and the Senate. But yeah, I mean, if you just look at it and say, why is it so different here? I mean, could things cost a little bit differently to build in Alabama than it does in Michigan? And could the land value be a little bit different, but not two-thirds different? There's something else besides this, and again, it's the particular approach that they've adopted, and I'm just trying to bring the rulings in the tax tribunal back to what I perceive and what I've done for the past 40-some years of my life as a professional appraiser using good, sound appraisal principles. And when the rulings come out, make sure that they've looked at the three approaches to value. They looked at certain issues, and especially when it comes to looking at properties that are old and vacant, especially with deed restrictions, that they really analyzed those and made a true determination that the highest and best use is the same for the comparable properties as it is for the property that's being appealed.
Where do things stand for your bill, HB 5578?
Well, we just finished our second hearing on my bill. We had a hearing the week before that, had several folks come in and testify, and then Wednesday we had two folks testify in favor of the bill, an attorney and a real estate appraiser, and we had two entities testify against it, the manufacturers and the retailers. But I believe that's all of the testimony we're going to have. Again, we had 2 days back in December, listened to lots of folks, and 2 days in the last 2 weeks. And in the process now of trying to address some concerns that have been raised by various entities and trying to make sure they understand the bill, I think part of it is a little complicated, dealing with not only appraisal theory but assessment, General Property Tax Act, and the tax tribunal rules. It takes a fair amount of expertise to appreciate the nuances of those three issues. Well, trying to address those concerns from some of the folks that have raised them, and then hopefully we'll be voting it out of, or taking a vote anyway, in committee pretty soon.
In bottom line, you're hoping to level the playing field for the communities that need the property taxes and the businesses, the property owners who need to protect their bottom line. You think this bill will do it?
I think it does. It doesn't favor one group over another. Again, if we're using the same approaches to value and making the tribunal recognize the same approaches to value that both the petitioner or the property owner would use and the respondent or the unit of government would use, I think it's a level playing field. Nobody's being given an advantage over one or the other party. Again, all looking at it from professional appraisal standards that have been around for decades and decades and decades. Everybody has the same opportunity to present their evidence. We just want the tribunal in its independent determination, which they must make. They simply don't pick one side or the other and say, well, you made a better case, you win. They're supposed to make an independent determination with the data that's presented to them. And my bill actually allows them, if there is something else that they need, to have to allow them, to enable them to make a good ruling, to reach back and request some information from the party saying, well, we'd like to take a look at this or that, or give me a brief on this, especially given it under Proposal A, that once you get a fairly major reduction, you basically have got that for the life of the store. I think the ramifications are too important not to make sure that all the information available to the tax tribunal when they make their ruling is in their hands.
Republican Representative David Maturin is from the 63rd House District in West Michigan. Representative, thanks so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure.
And we always like hearing from you. Tell us, what stories are you focusing on or people you think we should profile here on Stateside? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook by searching for Stateside. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio and MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Lighting things up, couches, mattresses, it's historically been a hallmark of students reacting to big wins or losses by the Michigan State University football and basketball teams. And then the city of East Lansing passed an ordinance aimed at cracking down on these fires and the big crowds. Basically, you couldn't be within 300 feet of a fire without putting it out or calling for help. But now local Judge Andrea Larkin has ruled this ordinance is not constitutional. Her ruling came in the case of two young women who were charged with violating the ordinance when police say they stayed within 300 feet of a mattress fire. The judge noted the city's ordinance didn't spell out how long you'd have to be near a fire before you break the law, and it didn't require police to warn you to leave the area before they arrest you. Lieutenant Scott Rigglesworth is with us now from the East Lansing Police Department. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
So this ordinance was, passed in 1999?
Well, that's a good question. I tried to get the answer to that yesterday. I thought it had only been around 5 or 6 years, but it sounds like it's been around a lot longer than that, which was a surprise to me. I've been here 22, but yeah, somewhere in the last 22 years they enacted the ordinance.
And what problems did the ordinance try to address?
Well, the main problem it addressed is when a fire was started, a crowd would almost inevitably form almost instantly. And then you get a bunch of oftentimes intoxicated kids standing around a fire, taking pictures, jumping through it, that kind of stuff. We needed a way to ensure public safety, and one of the ways I think the council decided or tried to do that was with this ordinance. And it basically said that you couldn't be within 300 feet of a fire unless you were trying to extinguish it or you were calling 911. So the real crux behind the ordinance was all public safety. We didn't want kids getting burned. Thank God in my 22 years here, we've never had somebody significantly injured or killed that I know of in a fire. But we didn't want to wait till that happened and then react with an ordinance after it. So I can tell you that in the years of enforcing this ordinance, it's not somebody we typically wouldn't either cite and or arrest somebody that was just, you know, casually walking by a fire. These are typically kids that are staying for an extended period of time, taking selfies, having a drink, et cetera, et cetera. And when they do that, it's inherently dangerous, and that was kind of the thought behind the ordinance.
Now, can you tell if there was a reduction in the number of these kind of celebratory fires after the ordinance came into effect?
Well, you know, just look back 2.5 years ago when Michigan State beat Ohio State in the Big Ten championship game. We had 60 fires in the city that night. 60.
60. So 60. Still, that's a lot of fires. And I do remember that night because we were telling our daughter, who was then at State, you just keep driving, don't go near it.
Right.
No go and look.
I can tell you what it did do.
What it did do is it
basically eliminated the huge crowds surrounding these fires. I mean, there was oftentimes we'd get a call of a fire in the middle of the street, and we'd go there. There'd be 500 people standing around it. And what we saw the ordinance really do as we started to enforce the ordinance is we would go to a lot of these fires, and there might be a handful of kids, or there might be actually nobody. So it really did increase public safety in that fact that I shouldn't say it eliminated, but it really reduced a large number of people standing around these fires. And the other part you got to remember, too, is the more people standing around it, the more dangerous it is for us and the fire department to get in there to try to put it out. The longer a fire goes, the bigger it gets typically. So those are all factors that I think went into establishing this ordinance.
Lieutenant, the attorney for one of the women in this case said the ordinance happened because basically East Lansing was embarrassed by all the national attention after Spartan wins and losses and these fires. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I don't think the city was ever embarrassed. We're not doing it. I mean, we're not setting the fires or standing around them. It was a black eye to the city that they were happening, and one of the things we needed to do is kind of think outside the box, if you will, is if there's ways that we could help reduce and or eliminate these fires. So, you know, I've always said that it's a tradition. In my opinion, it's an absolutely ridiculous tradition. It's a dangerous tradition. I don't get it. You know, one of the things that we've continued to work on around here is how can we eliminate these fires? And we've done reward money. We've done tip lines. We've done undercover stings. We've done plainclothes officers. And this ordinance is just one of many things we've tried to reduce the number of fires we have in the city. But unfortunately, I almost guarantee you next year, one if not more people will think during Welcome Week or the first home football game, which is September 2nd, that it'll be fun to set something on fire, go outside, get a selfie taken with it, post it on social media, that kind of stuff. And that's the other thing I wanted to add, too. With social media these days, you start a fire and there's 10 of your friends. Well, 10 of your friends are posting it online or on social media, and within minutes, there'll be hundreds of people running, literally running to the fire. If you remember the burn the couch sign that was held up when Michigan State was playing in Indianapolis?
Yes, yes.
There were literally people running from the dorms in Michigan State to Cedar Village as fast as they could when they saw that sign.
What about the concern expressed in this case that people who are just merely passing by or, quote, looking could be charged under the ordinance and unfairly?
Well, that's you know, up to the courts and attorneys and, you know, that part of the justice system to determine whether the ordinance is, one, enforceable, unconstitutional, whatever the case may be. You know, Judge Larkin made that determination last week, and I know that people within our organization are going to meet and see how we can go forward from here. But we've used the ordinance before. It seemed pretty effective in eliminating these big crowds around fires. I don't know how effective it was at actually reducing the amount of fires, but I think at its core it was built around public safety, and it certainly had a positive effect when it came to that.
So it seems from a police perspective you would like to see the city perhaps rework this ordinance and get something like it back in place, because it certainly seems like whatever existing ordinances were there weren't keeping these big gangs from standing around watching things burn.
I think that would be you know, our choice is to either reward the ordinance or rework it so we could still take some enforcement action. But that's for the powers to be. It's way above my pay grade, and we'll do what the courts and my chief of police say that we can do going from here.
East Lansing Police Department Lieutenant Scott Rigglesworth, thanks for being with us, Lieutenant.
You bet.
If you missed the show on the radio or you want to rehear an interview, you can always do it by catching us on iTunes. Search for Stateside, and while you're there, please give us a review, because we'd really like to hear what you think. The flood of headlines coming out of the water crisis in Flint comes down to a basic problem. The city was starved for cash, and that led to a series of bad decisions, and, well, here we are today. But Flint is not the only Michigan city caught in a cash crunch. All across the state, cities are starved for revenue, most of them not because of something the city has done, but because of things the state has done. Bridge Magazine writer Ron French is here with us to talk about a report he co-wrote with Mike Wilkinson, Flint Syndrome. Fewer cops, abandoned parks, town fundraisers to buy fire equipment, cuts to youth programs. Ron, what's going on here?
Yeah, it sounds pretty depressing, doesn't it? Well, this is something that a lot of people don't realize because it's happened gradually. You know, if you live in a city and over a period of 10 years, a park gets less and less taken care of, you don't really notice it as much. Mm-hmm. But when you take a step back, and Flint, unfortunately, has put us in a position of trying to take a look at that. You find that what happened in Flint really is happening to a lesser extent in other ways in cities all across Michigan. And it's not just these urban cities that some people say might be mismanaged. You have cities like Troy. You think, what could be wrong with Troy, you know, where 50% of their police are gone? Ann Arbor, my goodness, how much of a stronger city could you have than Ann Arbor? 1 out of 4 police are gone from a decade ago. There's a systemic issue going on here.
So it's this drip, drip, drip of things happening that gets to the point where you're calling this Flint syndrome. So define what you mean by Flint syndrome.
Well, everyone knows that in Flint there were a series of mistakes that led to the water, mm-hmm. drinking water being poisoned. It's a tragedy. It's a national tragedy. When you have the president coming in, you know there's an issue there. But at the root of those mistakes, what led to those mistakes were just a systemic disinvestment in that city. And it was something that the city had no control over. And why we call it the Flint syndrome is that people do not realize how many other cities across Michigan are dancing along the edge of a financial cliff, one mistake away from the same sort of thing happening to them.
And this isn't just something that we could say, well, the Great Recession hit and really punched our state in the gut. This goes back decades.
This goes back decades. This began in the 1970s and with a series of decisions, starting with, I won't bore you with all the details, mm-hmm. but with something called the Headley Amendment.
Give
in
us
the 1970s.
Hits. I remember the campaign for the Headley Amendment.
Yes.
Very.
And then the 1990s with Prop A combined what they did is that they limited a city's ability to collect property taxes. And that is how a city survives in Michigan, is on property taxes. Basically, the revenue a city collects from property taxes could go down rapidly, as it did during the recession, but it could not recover rapidly. After the recession, a city like Farmington Hills was one example. Okay, in Farmington Hills, it will take until the year 2038 for it to recover its property value revenue. Even though the property values have gone back up, mm-hmm. the revenue the city collects will not go up till 2038, and that's even without taking into account inflation.
The cities are handcuffed because of the Headley Amendment and Prop A and other factors, but it basically handcuffs them in order to collect revenue.
Absolutely. One person described it as the cities are bound and gagged, and there's no way for them to get out of it because they do not have control over the situation. On top of those two things, the other revenue stream is revenue sharing.
How does that work?
Revenue sharing is a percent of sales tax that the state is supposed to give back to cities, okay, to sort of even out funding from city to city. And part of it is constitutional, and they have to give a certain percentage. But part of it is there was a law saying how much they were supposed to give, but it's up to the legislature every year to decide. And so what are you going to do? Well, let's give some more money to something else. And that makes sense. You have to make choices. You have to make choices. And this wasn't just a Republican or Democrat thing. Yeah. It happened under Governor Granholm as a Democrat and now under Governor Snyder as a Republican. But since 2002, cities have been shorted by $5.5 billion. And you think about how much money that could make a difference, how much that could make a difference for cities like Flint. Flint's been shorted like $63 million itself.
So as my mother used to call it, borrowing from Peter to pay Paul, doing that shifting and taking money away from the cities, yet not giving the cities the ability to be able to raise their own taxes in order to make it up.
Absolutely. The good example here, a parallel that shows you the difference, is they've done the same thing over years at times with higher education, where they've cut higher education funding. Well, universities can turn around and increase tuition. Obviously, that has an impact on people, but there's a way out for them. Cities don't have a way out to collect that money they're losing from the state.
I'm talking with Bridge Magazine writer Ron French about his series of reports called Flint Syndrome. You contrast what things are like for cities like Flint and other Michigan cities with right across the border in Toledo. Here we have a post-industrial Rust Belt city, but things are different.
Absolutely. You would think that if a city were going to have problems here, they'd certainly have the same problems in Toledo. Now, Toledo's not Ann Arbor.
Right.
But it's a post-industrial city, lots of same sort of problems, but they're paying their bills. They have a police force that is twice the size per capita as Flint, and they have a good-sized middle class living inside the city limits.
Paying taxes. And they don't have Prop A and Headley.
Correct. And so the differences are, in Ohio, cities are allowed much more leeway in how they can collect income through revenue streams from their citizens.
And that's the lifeblood, as you say, that keeps the city going.
Absolutely. And, you know, no one wants to pay taxes, obviously. You know,
and clearly that was a big popular pitch in 1978 when Headley passed.
Right.
Right? Was that kind of why people bought into that? Yes, I want my taxes lowered. I don't
Oh,
want,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's only years later you start to see the impact. When you have cities, the city of Wayne has been reduced to the point that they are holding fundraisers to pay for new fire hoses. And they just had finished one for a new Jaws of Life, too. Now, when you get to the point where you're basically having bake sales to pay for your police and fire departments, there's a systemic problem there.
Are you a voice crying in the wilderness or about this? I'm sure there are a lot of conversations happening with a lot of municipal finance experts. Is anyone in Lansing listening?
That's a good question there, Cynthia. Yeah, I think there is some discussion of this now. That's beginning. Particularly, and no one would wish us anyone, but I think that because of Flint, because of that crisis, we can no longer avoid this conversation. That there has to be a talk about how we are funding our cities. And one obvious thing is making different decisions about how much revenue sharing we're giving our cities. The other is the emergency manager law, which is very different in other states. Here we're a cut-only sort of system. Once you get in trouble, you come in and you balance the budget as quickly as you can.
So you're chopping.
You're chopping. Let me give you an example. Another state we visited here for this series of stories was Pennsylvania. Mm. They have cities that aren't financially stressed also. But this pretty much sums up the difference between the two states. In Michigan, when a city becomes financially distressed, they are taken control of by the Department of Treasury. Okay, in Pennsylvania, it's the Department of Community and Economic Development. Now, think about the different mindset you have there. In Pennsylvania, the whole point when a city gets taken over is how do we build the revenue in that city so they can maintain themselves over a long period of time? Here, we cut as much as we can to balance the budget and we get out of town. Well, that doesn't change the systemic problems that those cities are facing.
I guess the question is, these are things that we as citizens, we're feeling the effect of fewer police and bake sales to buy fire hoses. What can we do as individuals to push for this? And would another step be a drive to get rid of Headley and Prop A? And would that ever pass?
That could be a drive to address those issues. That's a big, heavy lift.
Big, heavy lift.
I have a hard time seeing that happening,
yes,
at least in the short term. I think if there was concern about this, then when, you know, we have elections every couple of years, and you ask your legislators who are campaigning, how do you think cities should be funded? Do you think they should be getting more money? And how do you think that should happen? Put it on their radar. It's easy for legislators, especially with term limits, to lose track of how things were put in place. And they get distracted easily by the latest thing that's going on. So put it on their radar. Ask questions.
And if we continue along the road that we're on?
The cities are just going to get worse and worse. There is no way for them to recover without changes.
Ron French. You will find his series, Flint Syndrome, co-written with Mike Wilkinson, by going to bridgemi.com. Thanks so much for being with us, Ron.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is only one state in the entire country where, under the law, the governor is exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. And yes, that is Michigan. It is one big symptom of the transparency problem in this state, and why there's a bipartisan push in the legislature to bring more transparency to government. Michael Reitz is one of the voices calling for more transparency. He's executive vice president of the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, a conservative-leaning think tank that's based in Midland. Michael, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
You joined with Sierra Club Chair David Holtz in writing an editorial recently for the Detroit Free Press. And as you point out in the editorial, your respective organizations are often on opposite sides of issues, but you're uniting on this one. How important do you think it is to get the governor and the legislature under the umbrella of FOIA?
I think it's very important, and I think this is a issue that a lot of people now are paying close attention to. The recommendation to put the governor and the legislature under some sort of public records regime is not new. It's been kicked around in the legislature over many years. But with the Flint water crisis, I think this is a unique opportunity to really evaluate that question and make some progress.
We've certainly had it highlighted with the voluntary action by the governor to say, okay, I'll let you see the emails, and releasing them in these big batches. And I guess it is a pretty good reminder to people, he didn't have to do that, did he?
Right. It really was an extraordinary act, and I think the governor should be commended for it. You know, previous administrations have not been under, and even this one, have not been under any kind of obligation to release records. And to do so is quite notable. But obviously, the limitation there is that the office is making a determination about releasing. And so any other issue that is being debated in the governor's office doesn't have the same kind of transparency surrounding it.
Mike, we know that Michigan got an F, a failing grade, lowest grade possible, from the Center for Public Integrity in terms of transparency and accountability in our state government. How did we get there?
Well, you know, I'm not familiar with all the details of that report, but my understanding is it does include many other things besides open records and open meetings acts. When you're talking about transparency in public office, you certainly bring up issues of ethics and campaign finance and all these other matters that relate to the process of government. But when you look at the public records law in Michigan, we're actually a pretty good state in terms of how we handle public records and the distribution and disclosure of public records, with a couple of big exceptions. One of them is how much records cost. And then, of course, the other exception that we're talking about today, which is the executive and the legislative branches being exempt from any mandate for disclosure.
Right. And as you point out in your editorial, and we mentioned at the beginning, we are the only state where the governor is not subject.
That's right. The last state to remove the gubernatorial exemption was Louisiana. They did it back in 2009. And then since then, they've done a couple of revisions on that process. That leaves Michigan alone with a statutory exemption. There are a couple of states that have recognized through the courts that there might be limitations on what records you can get at in a governor's office. But in terms of what's on the books, we're the only state that does it quite like that.
Let's look at the efforts afoot in the legislature regarding FOIA. First, House Bills 5477 and 5478, which you call a thoughtful first step in the process of reform. These bills strip away the governor's FOIA exemption?
That's right, and that's really about all they do. They take away the current exemption in FOIA that would exempt the governor from complying with a records request. The legislation doesn't create any new exemptions. It doesn't create any new processes for how the governor should process a records request. What exists in the law would just simply apply to the governor's office, and we think that's a good approach, and we think it's time for the state to do it.
Then to the legislature, and let's talk about this separate set of bills that would set up the Legislative Open Records Act, or LORA. So, Mike, what do we get and what don't we get with the way the bills are now written?
Well, what we get is, for the very first time, the legislative branch in Michigan is subject to a mandate to disclose certain records, and we think that is commendable. We've worked with the sponsors on the legislation. We've testified on the legislation with some ideas for improving them. And ultimately, we think that this will be a good package of bills that moves forward in the legislature. There are a couple of ideas that we've discussed in terms of approving the bills, but I think the legislation overall represents a very significant step forward, where we're really seriously considering requiring some records of the legislative branch to be turned over to the public upon request.
But as you say in the headline to your editorial, transparency bills are promising but need work. Let's talk about some of these exemptions that the LORA bills would have at this point. What would be exempt?
Some of the exemptions that are written into the legislation are unique to the legislature. So they have to be considered with a little bit more care because they're not things that have been existing in law for a long time and they haven't been litigated or, you know, really worked through. One of them, for example, is constituent communication. The legislation currently exempts that. I think that's a perfectly acceptable exemption for the legislature. If I, in my private capacity, contact my lawmaker with a problem, I don't really expect that information to be made public to newspapers or other requesters. But then how broad that exemption goes would maybe be a question. If a lawmaker gets a request from a constituent and then goes to an agency to find out more about that issue, at what point does it no longer constitute constituent communication? So that's something that will probably have to be clarified either through legislation or amendments to it or just in practice once the legislature starts working through these issues. Another exemption is the caucus communications of the minority and majority caucuses. In the legislative process, the two caucuses will break up and discuss what they want to do on a particular piece of legislation, and that kind of communication would be exempt from disclosure. I don't see that changing in this legislative process. I think there are some things that lawmakers are just simply going to want to keep to themselves, and I don't anticipate that changing in the bill package.
There is a couple things that you pointed out in your editorial. First, the current bill draft provides this review process if the legislature, if I go and I want access to some kind of records and I'm told no, as you write, the citizens are denied a private right of action to take that denial to the court. So that's something missing?
Well, we've certainly raised that point with the committee and with the sponsors of the legislation. Currently, the appeals process is wholly contained within the legislature. And we think that, you know, ultimately, the ability for a citizen to take a records denial to the courts is sort of the final opportunity to resolve it. You know, you have a neutral arbitrator evaluating whether or not the denial was appropriate. That said, we think that the legislation needs to move forward, and you know, if there's a opportunity to fix that down the road, we would certainly support that. There are concerns that the lawmakers have raised about the separation of powers, and in the experience of a couple of other states, they've said the courts simply don't want to enforce a public records law when it involves the legislature because of concerns about the separation of powers. So I think there's probably more evaluation that needs to go into that question. I could anticipate changes to that approach down the road.
And also, you write about the LORA language as it defines the term public record. You say it's a rather unique manner. Talk about that a little.
Well, it is. And my understanding is that the sponsor is going to address this in a future iteration of the legislation. We pointed out that the definition of when a record becomes public in this legislation is after an agency has possessed the record for 15 days. In other words, right up until day 15, it's not a public record, and so you can't request it and you can't get it. Mm. And however that's handled, whether the legislature is given some time to hold on to records before they turn them over, or where they have a period like that where the records simply aren't considered public, the key thing is to make sure that the records are properly retained. I'm not accusing anyone of bad behavior, but you wouldn't want the scenario where someone is able to delete records before they actually become public.
As you say, there shouldn't be a maturation period for public records.
That's right. Either they are public or they're not. We don't need records to grow up after 15 days.
Mike, what's your call to action in what you wrote in the Free Press with David Holtz? What should people who want more transparency in state government be doing right now?
Well, I think the best thing that they can do is support their local lawmakers in this effort. You know, right now the bills are in committee, and so only a handful of lawmakers in the House have looked at this legislation. People need to let their lawmakers know that they think this is an important issue. And then, just as important, the legislation will go over to the Senate, and individuals will need to let their senators know what they think about the legislation.
Michael Reitz, Executive Vice President of the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Great talking about transparency with you, Michael. Thank you so much for being with us.
You bet. Thanks, Cindy.
Life is pleasant. Death is peaceful. It's the transition that's troublesome. That quip from writer Isaac Asimov might just explain why so many of us are so darn reluctant to talk about death. Although Hollywood doesn't mind poking its finger in the eye of the Grim Reaper.
Keep in mind, the root word of funeral is fun.
What can we do for you, sir?
I'm after a funeral.
Boy, are you in luck.
Unfortunately, our only options are cremation and burial.
Green funerals.
Oh, brother.
No caskets, no toxic chemicals to leach into the soil.
I want to be cremated. I want my ashes scattered over the sea. And damn anybody who touches me.
Gail Rubin makes it her mission to get us to think about death, to recognize that we humans are not getting out of here alive. So what are we going to do about it? Gail is a death educator, a certified thanatologist, and the author of A Good Goodbye, Funeral Planning for Those Who Don't Plan to Die. She's going to bring her death and humor message to Ann Arbor May 18th. But first, she is with us here on Stateside. Welcome, Gail.
Great to be with you, Cindy. Every day on this side of the sod is a good day.
Indeed. Or now departed Irish friend of mine said, no, I'm not ready for the berry hole yet. So, I have to say, I really love your catchphrase. Talking about sex won't make you pregnant. Talking about funerals won't make you dead. Start a conversation today. Why do we not want to take death out of the closet, Gail?
It can be attributed to Dr. Ernest Becker's terror management theory that he spells out in his book, The Denial of Death, which won a Pulitzer Prize back in the 1970s. We don't want to talk about something we're not comfortable with, and it takes good self-esteem to be able to consider your own mortality. And I heard Jack Canfield in talks referencing some study, which I've never been able to actually find, that says 2/3 of the adult population has low self-esteem. So look to your left, look to your right. One of you is okay, the other two are in trouble. And it's those 2/3, when you look at the rate of people who actually plan their funerals, do advanced medical directives, and even prepare wills, it's less than 30%. And I think it's that 30% that has the high self-esteem are the ones who are actually planning for death and talking about it and don't have a problem with it. So much of it is like, well, if I talk about it, it's going to happen. Well, you know, despite great advances in medical care, humans do still have a 100% mortality rate. And not talking about it does not help your loved ones or the medical community to deal with death when it will inevitably incur.
Yeah, let's talk about what happens when we do not talk about death and we don't take it out of the closet and have conversations. What are the results that you see?
Well, you have a lot of unnecessary stress because people don't have information pulled together. People don't know what your disposition preferences are. They don't know if you're in the hospital, if you want everything done, or if, you know, we should just let them go gently into that good night. And so there's a lot of confusion. People may overspend on a funeral out of guilt or grief. And it can be so much better if we just honestly talk to each other about, this is what I want, this is what I would like. If you can make it happen, that would be great. Just to give our loved ones some guidance about this transition from life to death, which will happen to us all.
And in your work, over the years of your work as a certified thanatologist, Gail, how have you seen people change once they're able to confront this reality that we aren't getting out of this life alive?
I get so many emails from people thanking me for doing this, getting out there, helping people laugh about death and break down that resistance, because then they will take the steps to write their advanced medical directives, to make a will, to even do their funeral plans. And I got to tell you, that's the best time to make your funeral plans is when nobody is dead. Mm. You know, you wouldn't go out shopping for a car and run right out and buy the first car that you came to when your car dies. But unfortunately, that is usually the case when a person dies. Very often we'll run out. Although, I got to tell you, the industry is changing in terms of helping people shop for information and prices online. And that's a big improvement in that regard.
Better for the consumer?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, there's a website, I will give them a plug, called parting.com that offers free listing of funeral home price lists online.
Gail, what brought you to this work of helping the rest of us face death and plan to die?
It's very interesting. I got married for the second time in 2000 and had a very creative Jewish Western wedding. And everybody had such a good time. I wanted to write a book about creative life cycle events and call it Matchings, Hatchings, and Dispatchings, about weddings and births and deaths.
Okay.
And I got to write a column in our local paper, a monthly feature by that name, and it was the columns on the dispatchings, the funerals and death, that got the most reader response. And it told me there's a real need to be able to talk about this. Instead of using euphemisms for death to actually say the D word, just like cancer used to not be talked about. Well, now we talk about it all the time. So I'm out here to get death out of the closet.
The doyen of death. What do you find are the most important and most inspiring end-of-life issues that we need to stop ignoring?
To actually be present when someone dies is a very sacred time, just like being present when someone is born. And I think we've gotten out of touch with actually experiencing or even seeing the bodies of dead people, or, you know, being witnessing that transition. And it's a very moving and inspiring thing to witness. And I think part of that, I was there when my father-in-law died, and that really made a huge impact on me. It was a beautiful passing. It's not something, obviously, most people do every day, except for people in hospitals. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so great that we have this Grief Week awareness event at the university to help the personnel who are in the hospital, the doctors, the nurses, and all the staff, to be able to process grief. And one of those points that I'm going to make in this talk is about the Buddha. We're bringing in all kinds of philosophies here. Said that attachments are at the root of suffering. So being able to be fully present and to release your attachments emotionally is a key to being calm and centered and present to witness these remarkable transitions that we have in our lives.
Gail Rubin is a certified thanatologist, a death educator, and she will be making these appearances on May 18th, two programs in Ann Arbor. You can get the details on those appearances and more, learn more about Gail's work helping us confront death and plan for it by going to her website, agoodgoodbye.com. That's agoodgoodbye.com. Gail Rubin, great to talk with you. Thank you so very much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.